death is something we all confront. It touches our family, our homes, our hearts. And yet we've grown used to denying its existence, treating it as an enemy to be beaten back with medical advances. We are living in a unique point in history. People are living longer than ever, but the longer we live, the more taboo and alien our mortality becomes. Yet we and our loved ones are still mortal. We struggle with this fact today as we have throughout our entire history. What led us to this point? What drove us to sanitize death and make it foreign and unfamiliar? These are questions that Brandi Scalace looks at in her new book, Death's Summer Coat, what the history of death and dying teaches us about life and living. The book is published by Pegasus, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Brandi Scalace to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on.
We on this program have talked much about death and dying and ultimately how to deal with it. You in this book look to the history of how we have dealt with it. What brought you to that very specific topic?
Well, you know, on one hand, I am a historian, and I work for the Dittrich Medical History Center and Museum, and so we specialize in history over there, and history of medicine specifically, which means that that's often the history of death and dying and life and living and illness and disease. So that's partly where this interest comes from, but I have a personal interest in it as well, as I think we all do.
And for you, that was what?
Well, there's been a lot of illness and death in my family, and so growing up, I had to face concepts of mortality, I think, in ways that you might not expect. So by the time I was 12 or 13 years old, my father had had a massive heart attack, and my mother had had cancer, and I remember being really aware that I might lose them and what that might mean for my future. I had a younger brother. I used to spend a lot of time sort of sitting outside their bedroom door at night to make sure they were still breathing. And, you know, those kinds of questions that I think we think we're immortal. A lot of times children sort of don't think about those things, or we think they don't. But it was very present to me in my lifetime.
But as you point out in the book, we haven't always had that feeling of being immortal.
That's true. Well, the alienation that I talk about in the book is I think, something that is a privilege, actually, of modern medicine and our modern lives. The fact that people, in general, do live longer and better lives and more healthy lives. There was a time, say, in the 18th century where you were lucky to make it past the age of five. People knew that the childhood mortality was very high. And so on one hand, you might have siblings that died very young. There was lots of disease, smallpox, polio, all sorts of things, diphtheria. So there was just a closer connection to understanding that life was ephemeral.
When, first of all, actually, before we go much further, talk about the title, Death's Summer Coat. That refers to what?
I get questions about that a lot. One of the things the book really seeks to do is to start a conversation about death before it happens. So it would not actually be a very good idea to think of winter only once winter got here, you know, and to not do any preparation. So in a sense, Death's Summer Coat is a suggestion that we think about death and dying before the actual moment occurs. So thinking about winter in the summer so that you're prepared for it.
You liken it in the book to the sex talk that many of us have had and have received, but we have that talk with our children. We do not have perhaps a death talk with our child.
Right. I think that's very, very rare. I mean, granted, my museum also has a large history of contraception exhibit, so I do birth and death all the time. I'll get you coming or going. But I think that we do recognize the importance that our children are going to encounter sexuality in their lifetimes. I think we sometimes forget that our children are going to encounter death and dying in their lifetimes, too. It's almost like we back burner that one, and we think, well, there's time. But sometimes there's not. As I said, I had to have those conversations much earlier in my life because of this. My brother was 8 years old, I believe, and my father had this massive heart attack, and my brother was the only one home. You know, it would have been good to have those conversations at an early age so that you understood what it was that you were facing.
When you look at the history, was there ever a golden age, if you will, of where we were good at this?
When we were better at death. It depends. Yes, actually. I mean, that sounds like a funny way of putting it, but I also look at the history of other cultures as well. And there have been times in our Western history and times in other cultural histories and even other cultures presently where there was an understanding that death was a part of life and part of a journey, and that, in fact, the grieving process was the business of the living. And so there was a sense in which you prepared for death and dying as yourself, but you also prepared for it through the deaths of other people. People used to wash the bodies at home before funeral homes and things like that, and so you would take care of the dying at home. You would take care of the body after death. You would take care of the preparations before burial. And so there's certain ritual tendencies that grew up around that that allowed you to process through the grief in a very different way than I think we do, where we're usually divorced from that process.
In being divorced from that process, and you do look at this in the book, of how we got that way. At what point did we start to, and yes, a lot of it has to do with medical science and medical marvels that allow us to live longer, but then there's also a psychological approach too, right?
Mm-hmm, there is. You know, I'm obviously a big fan of medicine in general, and so the book doesn't mean in any way to villainize our medical systems, but we do have a tendency to focus on the possibility of immortality and replacement parts and a sense that everything can be curable, so much so that I think we're then taken off guard and by surprise when something can't be cured, when the doctor can't fix it. So starting in the 18th century and in the 19th century and early 20th century, you're slowly getting a more scientific medicine, an understanding that medicine is scientific and that science, there's a real optimism about science and what it can fix and solve. And there's a sense, for a while, in that time period where you see people kind of thinking, well, if we can fix this, surely we can fix anything. And golly, you look at some of the things medicine has been able to do, replacement hearts, replacement kidneys, new advances in brain surgery, and you think, maybe it's true. Maybe we can thwart death indefinitely. But that's not really true. With the one thing we all have in common is we all got born and we're all going to die. And I think that that process that happens over a very long historical period and the fact that doctors have become much more specialized, so that means they're focusing on parts of your body rather than you as a completely conjoined whole, has really changed the way we've looked at what our body is for, what it does, and what it doesn't do.
And of course, this doesn't only impact our own mortality or how we think of our own mortality. It also, of course, comes into death and grieving of how it affects, as you mentioned with your family situation, of how it affects us when those around us pass away at what we perceive to be a fairly young age.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Death Unexpected was an article I wrote prior to the book coming out. But, you know, I think we can look at it in a very modern context. As of this past week, it's now 1 week since David Bowie died, and the outpouring of grief that we have seen online, on social media, really shows that, you know, just because you don't personally know someone doesn't mean that you're not affected, incredibly impacted by grief, by sadness over that loss. And so one of the interesting things about grieving is that it's such an individual process that it makes it very difficult to medicalize, actually. So some of the DSM criteria, the diagnostic manual for diagnosing people, well, some of the criteria for that says that where's the line between sadness and depression, it's very muddy water. One person might grieve for a loved one for years. Another person, maybe it's 6 months. You never really quit grieving in a wider context, but how it affects each person is so different. So how to medicalize that or how to not medicalize it is a very, very complicated question. Grief is a burden that you carry. Many people say you're never really the same after loss. It's more like learning to live with a kind of amputation. You've lost a part of yourself, and yet you go on. And I think that that's really difficult for us to get our heads around because we're a bit committed to this idea of there's some sort of normal psychology that we're aiming for, some fine line that we're supposed to get back to.
While I don't want to focus solely on David Bowie, you're right. It's a good example of a recent example of what many of us go through. And there's two things about his passing that I think, one was that it was a surprise. Most of us did not know that he had been going through a cancer treatment and for the past year and a half. So it was a surprise. The other thing is we think of 69 as being very young.
We do, and it's really interesting that you point that out. I actually wrote a blog post last week called The Stars Look Very Different Today in memoriam to David Bowie, and I talk about that. I say, you know, what's better? People used to say that the good death meant you knew long enough that you could prepare for it. On the other hand, many of us feel that a good death would mean that you went quickly and easily and quietly, right? So there's different ideas about what that means. Here's a man who prepared for it for a year without actually telling anybody that, well, I'm sure that his nearest associates, but the rest of the world didn't know that this was happening. Does the shock make it easier or does the shock make it more difficult? And it has to do with how we let go. Sometimes it's worse when you forget someone is gone. Do you know what I mean? And so it's not just remembering that they've died, but when those moments where you forget that they're gone, when you pick up the phone to call someone who isn't there anymore. And so for David Bowie was an interlocutor in a lot of people's heads. He was for me. I felt like I knew him through his art, and I think we all did. When you lose that, even though you haven't personally known that person, you feel deeply impacted by that, and it's not silly. It's actually a completely legitimate response. The second part of that, 69 seems young. You're absolutely right. That is absolutely true, though, of course, there's been times in our history, and it's true in other countries, in less developed countries, where that is an amazing achievement to arrive at 69.
Brandi Scavacci is the author of the new book, Death's Summer Coat, What the History of Death and Dying Teaches Us About Life and Living. I found your book to be especially illuminating in one fact, because it solved a mystery that I had in my own family. When we would go through photographs on the wall, when you grow up in a house and you have photographs of relatives all over the place, you don't even really look at them. You don't know who they are, and they're old, and they've been long dead before you were born. And there's just very much a disconnect between your world and theirs. And I remember very vividly, I was maybe 12 or 13 years old, and I was talking to my mother, and we were sort of going through the house of the various pictures on the wall. And I knew their names, but I didn't know much more than that. And she pointed to one photo, and she said, well, of course, that is Aunt Elva. And I said, not the most striking woman in the world. And she said, well, in that photo, she's dead. I remember, Brandi, that freaking me out. Why was the picture of this dead woman on our wall for all those years?
Yes, those were very popular, memento mori photography in the 19th century. And there's a couple of reasons behind that. One, if you go a little bit further back, daguerreotype photography is very expensive. And it's hard for us to get our minds around that because we all have iPhones. You know, so photographs are so disposable now. But they were very expensive. And you frequently did not have photographs taken of your loved ones as children. You know, you had a wedding photograph usually at some point in your life. So if you had a child that died or someone that died that was close to you and you wanted to remember them, you might have no other images of this person. So sometimes they would call people in who were trained to do this, and they would pose the body in a way that made it look alive. And they would then photograph it for you, sometimes with other living relatives. So, for instance, I have seen pictures of siblings where one of the siblings is dead. And it's sometimes very difficult to tell which one. And so you'll have these interesting conglomerations. It's a family photo. It's the only one we had. And that's just, you know, that's really strange to most of us. Most of us have a really hard time understanding, A, why you would do that, and B, why you would want it on your living room wall. But it also became something of a I hesitate to call it a fad, though in some ways it was. Mourning was a very big deal in Victorian England, especially, but also in Victorian era America, in that there were stages, there were types of clothing that you wore. You would hang your mirrors in black. You would hang your house in black. You'd wear black gloves. And it seems like a lot of trappings that would have been actually quite expensive. At the same time, it was really interesting physical representations of the stages of grief you were going through, which I think can be very useful. For me personally, it's nice to have sort of physical stages that you're processing through, and those kinds of images were one of those things.
Meanwhile, back at the funeral home, I am standing in line waiting at a wake last week for a friend who passed away at a very young age. And I noticed as I was winding my way through the funeral parlor that it was closed casket, which led me in the half hour or so that I had to get up to enter the room where the family was in talking to the funeral director. And because I'm an interviewer by nature, I just started to talk to them about, you know, funerals. And I said, what's the percentage of open casket versus closed casket? And the funeral director, who was very nice and very open, said, you know what? It's about 50-50. And I said, that's interesting. And he said, some families do both. They'll have an open casket viewing and a closed casket viewing. And I found that to be very interesting. And he said, but I'm really glad when people do closed casket. And I said, why is that? And he said, because the thing we're finding in the funeral industry is that more and more people are doing selfies with the body.
Oh, dear.
At the open casket selfie.
Interesting.
And I thought to myself, that's damn disturbing, isn't it? But I guess it isn't really much different than having an open casket. And also, back to what you were just talking about in this photography as a memento.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. And, you know, so because I work in the Dittrich Museum, we have a very large collection of dissection room photography. Of course, you don't do that now. Now it's very much against the ethics, and you would never take, or you're not supposed to take, selfies with your cadaver.
Yeah.
But there was a time when one of the most popular kinds of portraitures had to do with people taking pictures with the body that they were dissecting. And this is after the Browning cameras became popular, and so they were taking photographs that were about the size of postcards that you could share and send in the mail, for instance. So we have a huge collection of these where people were dissecting a body and then taking their photograph with the body that they were dissecting, which, again, to us that just seems so wrong and so strange. But is it that strange? It's a very odd concept. There's not actually, open caskets are not typically done in the UK, I discovered in my research. And, in fact, my editor, I published also the book first in England, was very surprised to find out how often it was done here in the United States. But I think that it does seem to have something to do with that final look, that last look. And to go back briefly to David Bowie, those last few photographs that were released of him before his death have become some of the most popular, they broke the internet, the most popular images of him.
Right. And is it a sense as, because if you are with any of us who have been with a person as they pass and shortly thereafter, what we see in that casket is very different than someone in the last stages of life who has then gone to death. And of course, the casket and that presentation is much better. So I understand that. But it is kind of a weird thing to get your mind around, and I guess I'm trying to ultimately put it into your historical context of, are we going to come to a point 50 years from now, 100 years from now, where we look at what our practices are and think of them as somewhat barbaric?
I'm sure we will. I'm sure that we'll do that with medicine as well. I feel certain at some point in the future we're going to look back and think today's most modern breakthroughs are some sort of archaic thing. But I do also think that, it's sometimes good to alienate our own practices. And what I mean by that is one of the benefits, I work for, I'm the managing editor for an anthropology journal, and one of the benefits of that is that when you go out and you look at another culture, I think the first tendency is to think, oh, they're so strange, is to kind of alienate them or to make them seem alien to us. But what happens is, as you begin to work more in understanding that other culture, you begin to see just how, quote-unquote, alien our own practices are. And I think those questions are really worth asking. You know, I remember when my grandfather died, asking things like, why do we embalm a body if we're just going to put it in the ground? You know, these are good questions.
Yeah.
Why do we have an open why do we have a wake for somebody who's permanently asleep? You know, there was these kinds of questions. And so in a way, I think all human rituals have two things about them. One, the human rituals that we practice can be both unfamiliarizing and yet familiarizing. So there's an uncanny experience as you're processing through the things that we do that you go, well, it's always done this way. Well, everybody does it this way. And then you look around and go, not everybody does it this way. Why have we chosen to do it this way? And I think it answers a lot of questions about ourselves.
Brandi Scalacci writes about the intersections of medicine, history, and literature. She works as a research associate and public engagement fellow for the Dittrich Museum of Medical History. She is also the managing editor of Culture, Medicine, and Psychiatry, a cross-cultural medical anthropology journal. And she's the author of the new book, Death's Summer Coat, What the History of Death and Dying Teaches Us About Life and Living. The book is published by Pegasus. Brandi Scalacci, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. I really appreciated being here. Thanks so much.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Death's Summer Coat. It is published by Pegasus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.